right. So, have you ever heard of someone getting convicted of conspiracy to commit murder even though they were acquitted of the murder itself? It sounds crazy, right? Like, how is that even possible?
Yeah, it definitely seems counterintuitive.
Well, we're diving into a California Supreme Court case today that deals with exactly that.
Oh, wow.
It's called People v. Swain, and it's a fascinating look at how the concept of intent plays out in conspiracy cases.
I'm intrigued already.
I think our listeners will be, too, especially all the legal professionals out there.
For sure, for sure.
This case, it really gets to the heart of some key legal distinctions, like the difference between express malice and implied malice.
And those distinctions can have huge implications, especially when it comes to jury instructions and how cases are actually argued in court.
Absolutely.
Plus, there are some really interesting concurring opinions in this case that could have a big impact on future trials and how these types of charges are even handled.
Exactly. So we'll definitely be unpacking those too.
Looking forward to it.
So to set the scene, we're going back to 1991, 2 a.m., in San Francisco's Hunters Point neighborhood.
Okay.
There's a drive-by shooting from a brown van, and tragically, a 15-year-old boy is killed.
Tragic.
Now, enter our two defendants, Jamal Swain and David Chapman.
Right.
Swain is alleged to have been the driver of the van.
Okay.
While Chapman was identified as one of the shooters firing from the van.
Gotcha.
But here's where it gets interesting.
Oh.
Swain claims he wasn't even in the van at the time of the shooting.
An alibi.
Exactly. He says he was at a relative's house in Berkeley that night, creating this factual dispute right from the start.
So we've got a contested alibi, a tragic shooting, and two defendants facing some very serious charges.
Right. And when the case went to trial, things took an even more unexpected turn.
How so?
Well, both Swain and Chapman were charged with murder, conspiracy to commit murder, and other related crimes.
Okay. That makes sense, given the circumstances.
But the jury's verdict ended up being, well, a little bit perplexing on the surface.
Okay, I'm all ears.
So they convicted Chapman of second-degree murder. Indeed, conspiracy to commit murder.
All right.
Makes sense so far.
Yeah.
But then they acquitted Swain of the murder charge.
Wait, what?
You heard that right.
So they didn't think he was involved in the actual killing.
It seems that way.
But
they found him guilty of conspiracy to commit second-degree murder.
Hold on. So they thought he was part of the plan, but not involved in the killing itself.
Exactly. And to make things even more complicated, they also found him guilty of attempting to dissuade a witness.
Wow. That's a lot to unpack.
It is. And that's precisely why this case ended up going through the appeals process.
Yeah. I can see why that verdict would raise some serious questions.
Absolutely. The Court of Appeal upheld the convictions initially.
Okay.
But the California Supreme Court decided to take a closer look because of the potential implications for conspiracy law.
So they recognized that this case had the potential to set a precedent.
Exactly. It delves into some fundamental questions about the nature of conspiracy and what it really takes to prove someone's involvement.
And that's where these concepts of express malice and implied malice come in, right?
You're exactly right. Those are at the very core of what the Supreme Court had to grapple with in this case.
So just to make sure everyone's on the same page, could we maybe break down the difference between those two types of malice? I think that would be helpful for our listeners.
Yeah, definitely. And I'll admit, even I get a little tripped up on those terms sometimes.
It's easy to do. They're very nuanced concepts.
All right. So help us out here. What exactly do we mean when we talk about express versus implied malice?
Okay. So think of express malice as the more straightforward scenario.
Okay.
It's that deliberate, conscious intent to kill, you know, like a premeditated attack where someone plans out a murder and then carries it out.
So like if someone hires a hitman or something like that.
Exactly. That's a clear example of express malice.
Got it.
Now, implied malice is a bit more fuzzy around the edges.
Okay, I could see how that might make things complicated.
It is.
So what exactly does it mean?
Well, it's about acting with such a reckless disregard for human life that even if you didn't specifically set out to kill someone, your actions demonstrate that you just didn't care about the possibility that someone could die.
Oh, okay. I think I'm starting to get it.
It's like, you know, if someone is driving drunk and speeding down a crowded street,
right,
they may not have intended to kill anyone, but they're being so reckless that death becomes a foreseeable consequence.
And that would be considered implied malice.
Precisely, because their actions show a conscious disregard for the very real danger they're creating.
That makes sense. So in this case, the court had to figure out if that level of implied malice, that disregard for human life, is enough to meet the intent requirement for a conspiracy conviction.
Exactly, because conspiracy isn't just about being in the wrong place at the wrong time, right?
Right, it's not guilt by association.
Yeah.
Exactly. Prosecutors have to prove that there was an actual agreement between two or more people to commit a crime and that each person involved had the specific intent to commit that crime.
And in this case, that crime was murder.
Right, so the question becomes, is implied malice enough to satisfy that specific intent element? Or do you need to prove that explicit, conscious, express malice?
That's where People v. Swain really dives into the heart of the matter, doesn't it?
It does, because we've got these seemingly contradictory verdicts for the two defendants, this key distinction between express and implied malice, and these very specific requirements for proving conspiracy.
So what did the Supreme Court ultimately decide?
Well, they ended up overturning the conspiracy convictions for both Swain and Chapman.
Really? Even for Chapman, who was found guilty of the actual murder?
Even for Chapman.
Wow.
Their reasoning was that implied malice simply isn't enough for a conviction of conspiracy to commit murder.
So even if a jury finds someone guilty of the murder itself?
Yes, and here's why. The problem was that the jury instructions in this case didn't properly differentiate between express and implied malice.
Ah, so the jury might have convicted Chapman of conspiracy based on implied malice, which the court now says is not enough.
Precisely.
Even though they found him guilty of the actual murder.
Right, because those flawed instructions meant that it's impossible to know for sure what the jury's reasoning was.
So essentially, the convictions were based on shaky ground.
Exactly. And there's another layer to this whole thing.
Oh.
The trial used general verdicts, you know, just guilty or not guilty.
Right.
But those general verdicts don't tell us whether the jury actually found that the defendants had that specific intent to kill.
So we're left with this uncertainty about their reasoning.
Right. And when you combine that with the flawed instructions on malice, it becomes clear that the convictions just couldn't stand.
So it's not just about their actions. It's about their state of mind, that specific intent, which can be so difficult to prove definitively.
Absolutely. And that's what makes this case so fascinating.
But didn't some of the justices on the Supreme Court actually disagree about how to approach this whole thing? Something about concurring opinions from Justice Mosk and Justice Kennard.
You're right. There was some disagreement within the court, even though they were unanimous in overturning the convictions.
Okay, so tell me more about that, because I think this is where things get even more interesting. Okay, so even though they agreed on the outcome, there were different perspectives on how to approach this whole conspiracy to commit murder thing.
Right. These concurring opinions are fascinating because they could really shape how these kinds of cases are handled moving forward.
So what were the sticking points? What were these two justices disagreeing on?
Well, Justice Mosk, he took a very interesting stance.
Okay.
He basically argued that the whole concept of conspiracy to commit second-degree murder, it just doesn't exist legally.
Whoa, hold on. Are you saying it's legally impossible to conspire to commit a less serious form of murder?
That's exactly what Justice Moss was saying.
I mean, that seems kind of extreme, doesn't it?
Well, his reasoning was that any agreement to kill, any agreement at all, it inherently involves some level of premeditation and deliberation, you know?
Okay.
So in his view, that automatically makes it first degree murder, regardless of how the actual killing happens.
So no matter what, if you conspire to kill, it's first degree.
According to Justice Mosk, yes.
That's a pretty bold statement.
It is.
So Mosk's saying there's only one type of conspiracy to commit murder.
Right, and it's always first degree.
Got it. So what about Justice Kennard then? What was her take on all this?
Justice Kennard, she had a different perspective.
Okay.
She believed that there should be separate degrees of conspiracy, just like there are separate degrees of murder.
So you could conspire to commit first-degree murder or you could conspire to commit second-degree murder.
Exactly. And the key factor for her was the level of premeditation and deliberation involved in the agreement itself.
I see. So it's not just about the outcome. It's about how the conspiracy was planned and what the intentions were.
Right. So, for example, imagine a group that carefully plans out a murder. You know, they stake out the location, they gather weapons, they make this detailed plan of attack.
Oh, wow.
In Kennard's view, that level of premeditation would point towards a conspiracy to commit first-degree murder.
Makes sense.
But on the other hand, let's say there's like a heated argument, you know, things get out of control, and in the heat of the moment, two people decide to kill someone without any real planning beforehand.
Okay, so it's more impulsive.
Right. So for Kennard, that might be considered a conspiracy to commit second-degree murder because the premeditation isn't as strong.
So it really comes down to the specifics of the agreement, the level of planning, all those details.
Exactly. It gets pretty nuanced.
It does. And I imagine this difference of opinion within the Supreme Court creates some challenges for prosecutors, right?
Absolutely. I mean, if you're a prosecutor, do you follow Moss's logic and only charge conspiracy to commit first-degree murder, even though that carries a much heavier sentence?
Right, because if you go for the more serious charge, there's a high risk that the whole case could fall apart.
Exactly.
But if you follow Kennard's approach and charge a lesser degree of conspiracy, well, that could mean a much lighter sentence if the defendant is convicted.
It's a tough call for sure.
It's a gamble either way.
And this whole debate also raises some interesting questions about double jeopardy.
Oh, so?
Well, if a defendant is acquitted of a certain charge, can they be retried on a different degree of conspiracy?
Oh, I see. Because wouldn't that violate their constitutional rights?
That's the question. And there's no easy answer.
It seems like People v. Swain, while it did clarify some things about express malice in conspiracy cases, it also opened up a whole new can of worms with these differing opinions about degrees of conspiracy.
You could say that.
And it makes you wonder, you know, if these debates continue, could focusing too much on the intricacies of premeditation and deliberation end up overshadowing the bigger picture?
What do you mean?
Well, I mean, ultimately, life was lost, right?
Right.
So how do we balance these really complex legal questions with the basic pursuit of justice? How do we make sure the legal system actually serves its purpose?
Those are some really big questions.
They are, and I don't think there are easy answers.
Definitely not, but they're important questions to consider.
Absolutely. This case really shows how, like, even seemingly straightforward legal ideas can get so complicated when you actually start digging into the nitty-gritty.
Yeah, totally. And that's what makes studying case law so engaging, right? It's not just about memorizing rules and stuff. It's about, like, understanding the logic behind them, you know, the arguments that went into shaping them, and the different perspectives that influence how the law actually works in the real world.
That's a great point. So for all our listeners out there, whether you're a lawyer, a law student, or just someone who finds this stuff interesting, what would you say is the biggest takeaway from our deep dive into People v. Swain?
Well, I think the most important thing to remember here is that you absolutely have to prove express malice in cases that involve conspiracy to commit murder.
Right. Like, that's non-negotiable.
Exactly. The California Supreme Court, they made it super clear that just proving implied malice, that reckless disregard for life, it's not enough for a conspiracy conviction.
So you can't just show that they were being careless?
Nope. To get a conviction on that charge, prosecutors have to go further.
Okay.
They need to prove that the defendants had that very specific conscious intention to kill.
Express malice. Got it. And we also can't forget about those concurring opinions, right?
Yeah, for sure.
And all the debate they've stirred up in the legal world.
Definitely. It's a good reminder that the law is always changing.
Yeah.
What seems like settled law today could be challenged and reinterpreted tomorrow.
Exactly. So as we wrap up our deep dive into People v. Swain, I want to leave our listeners with one final thought. If these differing views on degrees of conspiracy, you know, Justice Mosk's view versus Justice Kennard's view, if those continue to be debated, what could the long-term consequences be? Could getting too caught up in all the details about premeditation and deliberation actually distract from the fundamental issue? Well, the fact that a life was lost, you know, how do we find that balance between legal precision and actually achieving justice, especially in a system that, let's face it, isn't perfect?
Those are some really deep questions.
They are.
And to be honest, there are no easy answers. But that's the kind of stuff that lawyers, judges, and policymakers, they grapple with all the time, you know?
It's a constant struggle.
It is. It's a challenge, but it's also what makes working in the legal system so, well, so fascinating.
I agree. It's an ongoing conversation, this constant effort to, like, try to better understand justice and how to apply the law fairly.
And to protect people's rights.
Exactly. Well said. And on that note, I think we've reached the end of our deep dive into People v. Swain.
It's been a good one.
It has. It's been a really interesting journey into the complexities of conspiracy law, the differences between express and implied malice, and the lasting impact of this case.
Yeah, I've really enjoyed talking about this with you.
Me too. It just goes to show that even decisions from decades ago can still be relevant today and spark these important conversations.
Absolutely.
So to all our listeners out there, thank you for joining us on this deep dive.
Yeah, thanks for listening.
We hope you learned something new, maybe challenged some of your own assumptions, and even started thinking about some of those bigger questions about the law and its role in society.
Definitely.
Until next time, keep exploring, keep asking questions, and keep those conversations going.
We'll see you on the next deep dive.